Cool. All right. Hello, everyone. Thank you for being patient. Thank you for being here. My name is Suzanne Nasser, and I'm a full-time faculty member in the Counseling and Career Development Center right here on campus. On behalf of the Celebrating Diversity Task Force and members of the Arab Heritage Month Committee, which includes my dear friends and colleagues, Sundasmati McCarthy, Nina Shomadajani, Kip Kozad, Raya Judah, and Tamima Faruqi, I'd like to welcome you to today's event, Report from the Frontlines, the United States Palestinian Community Network's Delegation to Palestine, presented by Muhammad and Dania, who I'll introduce to you more in a bit. So how many of you knew or know that November is Arab Heritage Month, by a show of hands? Okay, so there's a few of you in the crowd. Very good. So Arab Heritage Month has been celebrated in Chicago since 1991, when the Advisory Council on Arab Affairs successfully lobbied the City Council to honor Arab Heritage during the month of November. Arab Heritage Month was created to help eliminate discrimination, bigotry, and racism against people of Arab descent by educating the public about Arab culture, civilization, and contributions to society. It is also an opportunity for us as Arabs to rejoice about who we are and to take pride in the rich culture, history, and traditions, especially at this difficult time in which Arabs and Muslims are criminalized, scapegoated, and attacked politically every day. We all know that there is a huge number of Arab students here, and Moraine Valley has had a long-standing tradition of participating in Arab Heritage Month and supporting this population. Every year, my colleagues and I, along with our hardworking Arab Student Union and Muslim Student Association members, look forward to celebrating this month on campus with all of you. It has afforded us the opportunity to put together numerous educational, social, and political events. Before I turn the floor over to our incredible presenters, I would be remiss to stand before you today and not acknowledge and honor the Palestinian lives in Gaza that are currently being taken away from us today as we sit here, as we gather, and have been taken away from us by the Israeli military for participating in the Great Return March Home. Many of you know that since March 30th, Palestinians living in Gaza have been peacefully protesting every Friday, demanding their internationally sanctioned right of return to the towns, cities, and villages they were ethnically cleansed from back in 1948. To date, more than 220 civilian protesters, including 34 children and 5 women, have been brutally murdered as they nonviolently demonstrated. We all keep in our hearts the victims and understand that we all have a role in helping to end the conflict. Educational and cultural events and political pressure on our government to end its support of Israeli violations of human rights all play a role in the struggle for justice for the Palestinian people. I'd now like to introduce you to Muhammad Sankari and Dania Zaytouni, who are both leading members of the U.S. Palestinian Community Network, a national Palestinian and Arab-based organization that was founded in 2006 to revitalize grassroots organizing in Palestinian communities in the U.S. USPCN has a long history of sending delegations to Palestine. Between 2000 and 2010, along with its precursor organizations, it sent almost 100 people, Arab American and solidarity activists, organizers, students, nurses, and lawyers on educational trips to Palestine. Dania and Muhammad were on the most recent delegation to Palestine this summer, and they are here today to share their journey with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
I guess we'd like to start first, of course. I can't do this. We'd like to start by thank you to Suzanne for inviting us, and to Moraine Valley Community College, of course, for hosting us. We're very excited to be here and to talk about our trip that we took. I don't know if this is on or not. I apologize if it's not. Okay, cool. To talk about our trip over this past summer. Just real quick tech question. Is there like a clicker?
Clicker.
Is there a clicker?
I can just do this too. I got long arms.
Usually is one.
Go back one slide.
Yep. We lost the next one.
Oh. There we go.
Okay, cool. Okay, we're good. All right, so again, my name is Mohammed, and I've been a member of the U.S. Palestinian Community Network for about 8 years now. And I just want to start off by introducing who USPCN is and the work that we do and kind of why we're here today. So Suzanne already mentioned that USPCN was founded in 2006 to revitalize grassroots organizing around Palestine in the United States across Arab and Palestinian communities. USPCN has a number of areas of work that we focus on. You can see them all listed up there. One of the first things that we focus on is the defense of political prisoners, Palestinian political prisoners, both in Palestine and in the United States. There's a number of high-profile Palestinian political prisoners in the United States still. Maybe most famously in the local area was the case of Rasmiya Ouda, who is a mentor, colleague of ours, who was deported last year, 2 years ago? I don't even remember anymore.
Last year.
deported last year, time flies. We were the lead organization for her political defense. BDS campaigns, BDS is a buzzword, of course, many of you maybe have heard of, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, which is an international movement that seeks to boycott, divest from, and sanction the state of Israel to force it to comply with international law and respect for Palestinian self-determination and international and human rights. We are proud supporters of Arab art and culture, both locally through promoting numerous local artists at our various events, as well as a partnership that we have with a Debka or folkloric dance troupe, which Daniel will be talking a little bit more about, that we visited in Palestine. Political education, like we're doing today. And probably most importantly to our work is working in coalition with other oppressed nationalities and oppressed communities. And so USPCN, we have a very strict line in upholding self-determination for the Palestinian struggle, but not only that, we have a very strict line of upholding the liberation of all oppressed people, including those who are oppressed in the United States, the Black Liberation Movement, the Chicano Liberation Movement, the Native Liberation Movement, and many, many others. We have the picture actually on the bottom of the bottom right there is a delegation of 30 young people under the age of 18 that we took to Ferguson after the murder of Mike Brown, and they went and met with on-the-ground organizers in Ferguson and took part in what was then called Ferguson October, a large demonstration of thousands of people. And we carry that really at the heart of our organization and understanding that if we believe in liberation and human rights, it cannot only be for our people, and we cannot get free unless all oppressed people get free. So just a two-sentence background on our delegation before we dive right in is we took a number of leading members of USPCN on a delegation to Palestine that lasted a little over 2 weeks. We visited, we're going to use maybe some terms interchangeably, and I want to just explain them all. We visited the West Bank, which is Israeli-occupied territory. We also visited what we'll call 1948 Palestine, which is now considered the State of Israel. And those were the two areas that we visited, from all the way in the north of Palestine to all the way in the south, which is the Nakab or Negev, across the West Bank, and we ended our delegation in the refugee camps of Jordan, which we'll also talk about a little bit more as well. I'll let Dania introduce herself because I should have done that before I went on that tangent. And then we'll jump right in with talking about what we saw, and the way that our presentation is really structured is about various organizations that we met with, the important work that they're doing, the repression that they face, and what does their fight back in that face of that repression look like. So I'll let Dania introduce herself, of course. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Dania. I'm also a member of U.S. Palestinian Community Network in our Chicago chapter, and I also went on this delegation that we're going to be talking about. That's it. That's who I am.
All right, and as soon as we get our beautiful slides back, it's all good.
Shouldn't say that on live. Shouldn't sing.
Well, in the meantime, actually, because there's really only like two photos on the next slide, so most of it is going to be us talking anyway. So the first kind of area of work that we wanted to talk about that we saw was work around political prisoners in Palestine. And so we visited a number of legal organizations, human rights organizations that focus on prisoners issues in Palestine. First and foremost is an organization called Damir, which is the foremost political prisoners legal representation and advocacy organization. And so I just wanted to start by talking about kind of the state of political prisoners in Palestine. So as of right now, there are over 6,000 Palestinian political prisoners in Israeli jails. 304 of them are minors under the age of 18. 63 of them are women. And 431 of those 6,000 people are what are held under what's called administrative detention. Has anyone ever heard of administrative detention? All right, cool, good. So you'll be learning at least one thing from us today. So administrative detention is a policy that the Israelis use in which someone can be held in prison for 6 months at a time and then extended indefinitely without any formal charges and without any evidence being presented against them. And so the youngest current administrative detainee, he may have been released, but I believe was 12 or 13 years old when we were in Palestine, and all the way up to well into adulthood. So administrative detention is a tactic that's used specifically to punish people who are politically active around the case of self-determination for the Palestinian people. Because without having to present any evidence, they're able to just indefinitely be held in military detention. They're brought in front of a military court every 6 months. There's no evidence presented. The state, which is the Israeli military, comes into the court in front of a military judge and says, this person is still a threat and we need them to be held for another 6 months. The judge will sign off on the documents and then the cycle will repeat itself. People can be held for years and years and years and years under administrative detention. And again, you have no right to see the evidence against you because it's national security. There are no formal charges against you to fight. And so one of the things that the prisoners had started to do while we were there is they organized a boycott of all of the military court proceedings for administrative detainees. And it was upheld by over 96% of the detainees while we were there. What they said is that we refuse to take part in this sham of military justice, quote unquote, and so we're not even going to go into the military courts. We're not going to give them any credence. We'll just boycott the proceedings because there really is no justice that can be had in these courts. Another very important area of work is focused specifically on children prisoners. Again, as of our time in Palestine, which was in July, there was 304 children in Israeli detention. And we met with an organization that's called the Defense of Children International, and they have a branch in Palestine. They're based out of the European Union. They have branches all over the world. And they focus on the rights of children prisoners. And what we found out was really the systemic and massive mistreatment of minors in the lead up to and during the process of being incarcerated. And so things that were routine are night raids, minors being torn away from their families in the middle of the night, taken to be interrogated in military holding areas. They will then not be given access to an attorney. They will not be able to talk to their families, and they'll be put through hours and hours of an interrogation process. There's been a number of high-profile young people who, within the last year, have been who have reached international acclaim that went through this. One of them's name is Ahmed Manasra, and he very famously was put through an interrogation, a very rough interrogation that was caught on camera, in which, it's a young child in front of a soldier, and he just kept saying over and over in Arabic, "I don't know, I don't remember, I don't know, I don't remember," and he was in tears as they were berating him. Another very famous case was Ahed Tamimi, who was a young girl from Nabi Saleh, who was arrested by soldiers after a confrontation in which they raided their village, and she slapped one of the soldiers. And the soldier started to use very inappropriate language with her, talking about how beautiful she was and sexualizing her. She's a 16-year-old girl. And so these are the kinds of processes that happen to children during the military detention. During the military detention process, right? In addition to numerous accounts of physical abuse and mental abuse, psychological abuse, and increasing amounts of accounts of sexual abuse as well. But more importantly, we're not just here to talk about how terrible things are and all of us go home feeling awful. In the face of repression, people oftentimes fight back, and it's no different in the case of Palestinians. And so for prisoners, we had already talked about the boycott of the military court proceeding. Prisoners have also used used tactics that have been used by political prisoners all around the world, such as hunger strikes. Most recently, 2 years ago, there was a massive hunger strike of thousands of prisoners that was coordinated, demanding an improvement of their conditions in the prisons, and that those kinds of hunger strikes and organizing around them continues to this day. And education amongst the prisoners is another big piece. So one of the things, especially for children, is that if they're arrested, let's say, and held for 3 months or 4 months or 6 months under administrative detention, they'll miss out on a whole school year. And so what prisoners have done is they've kind of self-organized education within the prisons. There's a famous Palestinian Legislative Council member named Khalid al-Jarrar who organized a class around international law and international legal advocacy for women, young women in prisons. And she taught this class that would teach them around, specifically around international law, the rights of prisoners under international law, and how to advocate under international law. And because of that, the Israelis actually forced the class to be closed. They separated her and transferred her to another prison because they saw kind of the impact she was having on the lives of these young women. And so when we had asked the organizations that work with prisoners what did they want us to do from the United States, they said, step up our game in terms of solidarity, in terms of talking about the issue of prisoners. And I just want to shout out that there is actually a bill in Congress, I can't remember what it's called, I can't remember the number, but it's sponsored by Representative Betty McCullough in Minneapolis. And it's a bill that would say, that specifically says that aid sent to the Israelis from the United States government cannot be used to commit human rights violations against children prisoners. So it's not like super broad, it's not super radical, it's very basic in terms of that the money that the United States sends in aid cannot be used to violate the rights of children prisoners. And we also, USPCN, will have more projects that are in the works with the Damir and others coming up. And I will pass it to Dania to talk about our next section. we got logged out. Okay, it's okay.
Okay.
And she's going to talk about cultural resistance, I believe.
Okay. Are you sure that's next?
I think that's next.
Yeah. Sorry. Hi. So we had some really cool pictures, but I guess we'll see them soon, hopefully. I'll be sharing our analysis and our experience of three major cultural institutions in Palestine, including who they are and also what is their significance in the Palestinian resistance. So the first institution is called the Arab Hebrew Theater in Yaffa, which is based in 1948 Palestine, what people call today the State of Israel. And because of where they are based, Palestinians are forced to include Hebrew in the name in order to be inclusive of the Israeli settlers and actually remain in operation where they are. Despite the name, however, we believe that the existence of a theater that promotes Palestinian culture in 1948 Palestine is very special and very important, right? It has also even greater significance because it is in Yaffa. And it was actually a member of the theater who told us Yaffa's historic role as both a cultural and a political center during the 1936 Great Revolt against the British occupation, which some of you may know was the largest general strike in history. And our analysis is also that by asserting the values of Palestinian traditions against the dehumanization of Israeli colonialism. This type of cultural resistance helps to create a bond between our people, to make people feel love for each other, and this actually helps us motivate each other in the struggle for collective freedom. So it's a very important work that we consider part of resistance. And the second major cultural institution that we visited was called the Freedom Theater. We had a photo of it, but it's based in the Jenin refugee camp, which is, of course, in the West Bank. So they operate under the increasingly repressive conditions of Israeli military occupation. Actually, the Freedom Theater was totally razed to the ground by the Israeli military in 2002, which some of you may know is during the Second Intifada, or what we say, it's in English, it's the popular uprising. So this theater has also been repeatedly raided by the Israeli military. That means they go, they storm the theater, they beat people, they arrest people, all for practicing art and theater. In 2012, so pretty recently, the artistic director of the theater was not only arrested, he was held incommunicado in Israeli prison, and he was subjected to both psychological and physical torture. The Freedom Theater, we must say, promotes explicitly political plays, including stories of political prisoners in the Jenin refugee camp where they're based. Some of them are members of the Freedom Theater, those political prisoners. This is the reason why we believe the Freedom Theater, to us, is a model of cultural resistance. Because, you know, for art to be truly for and of the people, our analysis is that it needs to be oriented towards promoting the popular demands and stories of Palestinian resistance. This way, cultural work becomes integrated with the overall struggle for liberation, and not, in the words of the Freedom Theater, a substitute or a replacement for other forms of resistance. Because, in my opinion, it's impossible to even talk about preserving culture or preserving identity without talking about how do we confront the conditions that threaten our culture and threaten our identity in the first place. So one of their productions that I just want to uplift that they perform as a theater is called Our Sign is the Stone. And Our Sign is the Stone is a play based on real testimonies that people from the Freedom Theater gather from a village, and this village is called Nabi Saleh. It's very famous in Palestine. As Muhammad said, Ahad Tamimi is from that village, and it's also famous because, in general, it's a stronghold of resistance. So the play focuses on a specific boy from Nabi Saleh, and it traces his political development as he organizes his community in an extraordinary campaign against the Israeli occupiers. So each performance in Our Sign is the Stone is also followed by what they call like a playback. And this thing that they do is where audience members get to share their stories about their life and their resistance under Israeli occupation. So that kind of gives you an idea of how they use art to also organize their community. And the third and the last cultural institution that I want to focus on is, of course, our close friends and our partner organization, the Wishah Debka Troupe. And the Wishah Debka Troupe is based in a city called Ramallah and the West Bank. And Wishah was founded by our friend Muhammad Ghatta. And Muhammad Ghatta is one of the most prominent choreographers and cultural icons in Palestine. Muhammad Ghatta was the original co-founder of El Fanoon Debka Troupe, which some of you may know is the oldest and the most prominent Debka Troupe out of Palestine historically. When we met with Muhammad Ghatta, he said that he created Wishah after El Fanoon In order to preserve and to practice the traditional, strictly folkloric style of dance, because like nowadays, people do depke, but they add like a contemporary twist. So this is how he's saying we need to preserve this traditional style of dance. They also use like their cultural work in a very similar way to the Freedom Theater, in that their dance productions aim to popularize and to express the story of Palestinian resistance. So from the steadfastness of political prisoners to the joy of community celebrations, that is what they highlight in their dance productions. And even though Wishar is based in a big city like Ramallah, right? They always travel to the villages and the people that don't have money to cross military occupation barriers. So we find that very important that this organization does that. Like when they perform in areas that don't have access to professional sound or professional lighting, they literally take their own stage and they build it in an open area. They also explicitly do outreach programs in various refugee camps. Of course, the dancers of Wishah are also organizers in other fronts of struggle. And some of them, of course, face repression for the work that they do. But something that they said that I just want to highlight is that they said even to be imprisoned in Israeli jail would not stop them. And they even said they would continue to write choreography and to dance in the Israeli prisons if that happens to them. So we just, you know, this is why we think this is such an important organization and why we partner with them. And actually, we're going to be co-sponsoring another tour of Wishah in the United States in multiple cities. It will hopefully be sometime in the spring. So by staying connected with us, this is a way, of course, you can support their amazing work that deserves to be supported.
Yeah, so another kind of front of struggle that we witnessed and that we want to talk about. All right, round of applause for the tech guys.
Yay. Yeah. Wait, can we just show the pictures really quick? No? So this is Odomir's office that we already talked about. This is in their office, a wall of photos of political prisoners that when you walk in, you see the faces of repression. And that is a banner that came from Chicago that this is one thing that we do. We sent it to Palestine. It was a letter to the Palestinian prisoners, and they kept it in their office so that their clients can see that they have support in Chicago. And this is the front of the Freedom Theater that I just mentioned. It's a mural. Right when you walk in to the Freedom Theater, you see this beautiful mural that symbolizes cultural resistance. And, you know, it's to inspire people and to give people this sense of community. And this is the office of Wishah's Depke Troupe that we visited in Ramallah. These are photos we took, but the photo on the right is just a photo of them at a performance, so you can kind of see like what it looks like when they're in action. So yeah.
All right, cool. So the next kind of sector of work that we want to talk about is health and environmental work. Health and environmental work. So the first organization that I want to talk about is one that's called the Health Workers Committee, and I just lost my place. The Health Workers Committee. So the Health Workers Committee was a really amazing organization that really flips the idea of how to provide health services on its head in the conditions that they live in. So first and foremost, one of the most important areas of their work is women's health services. So the Health Workers Committee opened up the first ever breast cancer center in Palestine called the Dunya Center. And while we were there, they talked about how breast cancer is the number one cancer killer for women in Palestine. And the main reason why it is a killer for women in Palestine is because of lack of access to health resources and the inability for early detection as a result of that. And so the cancer develops very, very, very aggressively and in a late stage by the time women find that they have it, and it leads to a high mortality rate. In addition to these cancer services that they offer at the Dunya Center, they also do phenomenal work around domestic violence prevention and intervention for Palestinian women, as well as The core of all of their work includes a component of popular education and leadership development. And so they have a large base of women that they work with in this leadership development model, and these are all of the women that are receiving health services from them as well. In addition to women's services, they also operate mobile clinics all across Palestine. One of the places that they operate in is the Jordan Valley. And the Jordan Valley is one of the most hyper-militarized places in Palestine. These are areas in which kind of the most extreme of the Israeli settlers are, and they're protected by numerous military outposts. And oftentimes these are then designated as quote-unquote military areas in which people are not allowed to be in. That doesn't change the fact that Palestinians still live there. And so the Health Work Committee sets up these mobile clinics that go around and provide services on-site for people, health services on-site for people in these areas. Specifically, one of the highest impacted communities are Bedouins who live across the West Bank and are really left out of kind of the traditional healthcare sector in Palestine. In another very important area of their work is in Jerusalem, and I'm sure many of you know that Jerusalem is probably one of the most hotly contested, debated, however we want to call it, issues right now. And the entire city of Jerusalem is under complete Israeli military control, right? But the Health Workers Committee has what they call a strict non-normalization policy, which means that they refuse to normalize any form of military occupation or any form of apartheid. And so they actually refuse to get any kind of permits from the Israeli authorities to enter and leave Jerusalem. Just as a side note, there's over 101 different kind of permits that control Palestinians' movement from the State of Israel. So very famously in South Africa, they had a permit regime that restricted how South Africans would be able to move around. Similarly, the State of Israel has 101 different types of permits that restrict Palestinians' movements. So the Health Workers Committee refuses to engage in the permit system, and they just drive their ambulances through the checkpoints. And so what that means is oftentimes their workers are put in danger. It can be the danger of arrest or worse. And all of their workers know this and take it upon themselves to make that commitment of, I have a person in my ambulance that needs to get health services, and regardless of the military regime, I'm not going to ask for permission. I'm going to force them to allow this person to get help. So it's not like they hit the gas and don't stop, but they drive up to the checkpoint without permits and say, I have a person in this ambulance that is going to this hospital, you know, غصب عنكم, essentially, as we say in Arabic. What that means is then, of course, they face a very high level of repression. So this can be arrest and detention of all of their staff members, as well as a repression of the their center and organization. So they have a famous youth center inside of Jerusalem that was called the Nidal Youth Center, and it was actually closed 4 years ago by order of the Israeli military because of the work that the Health Workers Committee was doing. In addition to the important work of the Health Workers Committee, we also got to meet two very, very, very amazing institutions called Arij and the Besma Center. So Arij is the Applied Research Institute of Jerusalem, and they have a very, again, unique perspective. What they called it is they understand an organic relationship between the environment and urban planning and occupation. And so what they do is they look at the environmental impacts of the occupation and create alternatives to it. One of the large things that they do is working on water and water resources. Across the world, there's a crisis of water access, and Palestine is no different. The difference in Palestine is that all of the water resources, whether it's in the State of Israel or in the West Bank under military occupation, are controlled by the Israeli authorities. Palestinians are not allowed to dig wells, even, on their own land, because all of the water table is owned by the Israeli authorities. So what Arij does is they have, there are hundreds of old Roman wells across Palestine from the era of the Romans. And they go and refurbish these Roman wells to allow people to be able to get water from them again and survive off of it. The United Nations actually has a system of these water tankers. Anyone who's ever been to the Arab world, and specifically Palestine, you have probably seen these big black plastic containers that are put on the top of buildings and bake in the sun all day. And so there's no cold water from them. On the flip side, well water is very cold. It's refreshing as opposed to like 200 degree water coming out of the tankers. And so what they do is they encourage people to be able to create these kind and refurbish these kinds of resources for access to water. Another big piece of water access, of course, is what you do with wastewater. And so they build these amazing wastewater reclamation facilities, essentially, that can be run by Palestinians who live in these villages. They don't take tons of material or capital investment outside of the building of them, and then they're allowed to be run, and they train people in the villages to run so that wastewater can be reused, for example, for non-food agriculture or for animals, or so that they're really getting the most use out of the very scarce resource of water that they have. They're also on the cutting edge of solar power and hydroponics. So they build build mobile solar panels that people can use in their villages. And the reason why they're mobile is because the Israeli military will destroy them. And so they put them on wheels so that if there is a raid, people can wheel the solar panels around and move them, especially for Bedouins who are semi-nomadic, which we'll talk about a little bit more. They'll be able to take solar panels with them. And then hydroponics they have this project in which they create these hydroponic farms for other organizations so that they have better use of the resources and can create or grow more food with less water and soil resources. And this actually leads me to the next organization on there, the Arab Women's Union and El Besma Center. So the Arab Women's Union is in Beit Sahur, which is a village right outside of Bethlehem. They host a center called the El Besma Center. And El Besma Center is a center for adults with disabilities, primarily developmental disabilities. And they do very important work with adults with developmental disabilities, providing them with life skills, providing them with job skills that comes out of this hydroponic farm that they have on their land that was built with help from ARIJ, the Applied Research Institute. And so adults with developmental disabilities grow and harvest crops and prepare food from these crops and sell it to the local villagers. And what they talked about is instead of people getting fast food, what people can do is when they get off of work, they call the El Besma Center and say, "What have you all cooked today?" And they'll say, you know, whatever, mluchiye. And so you can place an order, you can pick it up after work, and what you do is you go and pick up your food that's all prepared for you, and you can feed your family a healthy meal while still working. That provides a healthy alternative to fast food, and it actually is providing jobs for adults with developmental disabilities and jobs for women that are working at the Arab Women's Union. The Arab Women's Union, just on a side note, also has a guest house, so it was essentially like a hostel that we stayed in, which had the most amazing staff people who were the most caring people that we probably came across in Palestine, and really treated us like we were their own children. Really the moral of all of this for us was, even under the very harsh reality of occupation and apartheid, there all of these creative alternatives that are being brought up by these different Palestinian organizations as a way to meet both health and environmental needs, so that they're planning not only of how do we resist politically, but how do we sustain ourselves in the long term, and how do we sustain our land for the next phase of what happens next. So that's health and environment.
So the last major front of struggle that we're going to be reporting on in the Palestinian resistance is against Israeli land theft and settler expansion. This photo is obviously in Beit Lahem. It's the apartheid wall. And the other photo is actually a really cool poem that we saw about Jerusalem that I liked. And it says, "No garments on me except Jerusalem and the olive tree of Al-Aqsa and the bell of the holy tomb. So transparent, so faint like a cloud. I am ceremonial, shrouded like a martyr and like a gorilla coming from a distant wound." So I'll start by focusing on Jerusalem, where we actually witnessed some of the most ugly and intense faces of Israeli land theft and settler expansion. So we witnessed firsthand how the apartheid wall is built on Palestinian land. So it not only cuts through their land, it also divides Palestinian properties in half. And it is being used in Jerusalem specifically to rezone the city so that there's less Palestinians inside of Jerusalem and more illegal Jewish-only settlements inside. So the construction of these illegal Jewish-only settlements in Jerusalem in particular and in Palestine as a whole is very strategic. Why do I say that? Because the way the settlements are built is that they're built on the edge of a Palestinian village in order to encircle them and to isolate them, or they're built in the middle of a village literally to separate and to fragment the village. So the policy and the strategy, really, of settlement expansion is very strategic because this makes a contiguous Palestinian state impossible. So some people, they ask us, you know, like, what excuses do the Israelis use to steal the land in the first place, you know, besides the whole Zionism, God gave it to us, whatever crap. The answer is that, you know, Israel has actual policies and laws designed to legalize the confiscation of Palestinian land and Palestinian property. So in many areas, the Israel Land and Parks Authority will designate land and property as a green area or as a national park. So this gives the Israelis the authority to not only prohibit residential construction, like, oh, you can't live there because this is a park, but also they'll just demolish any homes that are already there to make it a green area. And this means that the park, obviously, what Palestinians gonna want to go to a park that was built on top of their ethnically cleansed home? It's mostly illegal settlers that hang out in these weird parks. So Israel also, you know, they attempt to control the demographics of Jerusalem in another very important way, and this is through the ID system. So some of you may know there's three types of IDs that a Palestinian can have. Number one, if you live in the West Bank. Number two, if you live in Gaza. And number three, special ID just for Jerusalem. So it is Israel who decides who's a Jerusalemite, who's a West Banker, and who is a Gazan. And Palestinians in Jerusalem, you can have your ID revoked if you're unable to prove what the Israelis call, very ambiguously, your center of life. So what does that mean? You know, if a Palestinian from Jerusalem, for example, if you decide, I want to get married to someone who lives in the West Bank, now your center of life isn't there. You need to apply for a very long process of family unification that needs to be approved by the Israeli Minister of Interior. And very conveniently, Israel froze this process. Nobody can do this anymore after 2002. So what has happened, there are thousands of Palestinians who live illegally in Jerusalem, their own land. And if you live illegally in a place, obviously, what does that mean? You can be deported away from Jerusalem, your home, your family, away to the West Bank. And also, if you're living illegally, it means you don't get any social benefits, even though you are paying taxes. So meanwhile, keeping this in mind, there is also, on top of it, constant harassment by Israeli police, especially against Palestinian youth in Jerusalem. This also intensifies the pressure on them to leave. the largest number of arrests of Palestinian children in Palestine occurs in Jerusalem. So we met with a youth center in Jerusalem, specifically in Sheikh Jarrah, which is a stronghold of Palestinian resistance in Jerusalem. And they were formed to address the needs of those imprisoned Palestinian youth. And this is called Al Bustan Association. What they offer to the youth, they provide free legal awareness, free social support groups for the families of people that are directly impacted. And Al Bustan Association was also formed initially out of the need to mobilize against the immediate threat of demolition for their entire village, what they call the 88 families, which today they continue to resist. And actually, the founder of Al Bustan, whose name is Dawood, was our local guide in Jerusalem, who took us around the old city and otherwise. And he explained all of the policies of land theft, settler expansion, and overall repression in Jerusalem within the context of what's called the Greater Jerusalem Plan. Sounds very fancy. It's a plan that refers to a very specific and special plan the Israelis have just for Jerusalem. So part of this plan is not only the construction of hundreds of illegal settlements in Jerusalem, but actually to rezone Jerusalem so that all of the settlements in Jerusalem are linked to all of the settlements in the West Bank. Some of you may be familiar with a village that was demolished or targeted for demolition recently called Khan al-Ahmar, which is in the West Bank. So they want to build a settlement on top of it. And this was part of the Greater Jerusalem plan. It's not in Jerusalem, but they want to connect the settlement to Jerusalem. So that way this will advance their land theft. And of course, Al Bustan is resisting this plan through their political tours of Jerusalem, that like the one we took, by showing people, and especially the youth, who does Jerusalem belong to. Dawood and his family have lived in Jerusalem for over 200 years, he told us. 200 years his lineage can be traced in Jerusalem. So this is long before the idea of Zionism was even a twinkle in the eye of Theodore Herzl, and this 200 years is long before the state of Israel was even created. And of course, lastly, the community in Jerusalem that undeniably represents resistance towards all of the Israeli colonial schemes and scams is the Afro-Palestinian community. So we visited the Afro-Palestinian quarter of the Old City in our tour, and over 50 families reside in this quarter, and their African descendant Palestinian, whose ancestors came to Jerusalem initially either as religious pilgrims, or they migrated from East Africa in order to fight alongside the Palestinian Arab fighters in 1948 during what we call the Nakba, or the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, against the Zionist gangs who carried out genocide and terrorism to establish their Jewish-only state. So it is really important for us to mention the Afro-Palestinian community, because not only does their resistance date back to literally before the state of Israel was created, but they confront the daily brutality of occupation, not only as Palestinian Arabs, but also as African descendants who confront vicious racism by the Israeli soldiers that we saw firsthand. So not only by soldiers, but also by the settlers in Jerusalem. And we say, you know, so when we talk about who does Jerusalem belong to, we always need to uplift the Afro-Palestinian community. And the second area, I think we have a slide for it. Yes? No. Just kidding. We don't have a slide for it, but I'm going to tell you about it. It's called Al Khalil. So the area, Al Khalil, some people also call it Hebron, it's a very similar situation to Jerusalem in that it's one of the highest levels of repression in Palestine, and Al Khalil is in the West Bank, however. And the reason why they faced such high repression in Al-Khalil is because of the location of the settlements. And Al-Khalil, it's the only Palestinian city in the West Bank where the settlements are actually inside of the city. So usually the settlements are in their own area. Here, they're literally inside of the city. So Palestinians living around the settlements, all around it, they're subjected to high levels of violence from the Israeli settlers, the police, and the soldiers who protect the settlers. Something that is very noteworthy is the settlers in Al-Khalil are, it's a stronghold for basically the Jewish extremist movements, including some of you may be familiar with the Kahanists, maybe? Have people heard of the Kahanist movement? No? Okay, so basically, the Kahanists are inspired by the Jewish Defense League, which was formed in the United States. They carried out an assassination of an Arab American in the United States that the U.S. government refused to investigate, even though they're labeled as a terrorist organization. Basically, the Kahanists use open terrorist tactics to achieve their goals. So they attempted to blow up the Dome of the Rock in Palestine, and they committed a massacre in Masjid al-Ibrahimi, and they murdered 29 Muslim worshippers in one go. So after this massacre in Masjid al-Ibrahimi, it's noteworthy because the Israeli army closed the commercial street, the main commercial street where all the businesses are in Al-Khalil. And we call this Shuhada Street or Martyr Street. So an organization in Al-Khalil that we met with, where one person who works with them still has a Palestinian shop on this street that today is still open. They were called the Human Rights Defenders. And basically they document all of the repressive acts by the Israeli soldiers and the settlers in order to really raise public awareness and place public pressure on the Israelis. And I think we're going to show a short video.
Well, how are we on time? Maybe let's figure that out. What time is it now?
Oh. Okay, we'll skip the video. Basically, in the video, we just wanted to show you the street itself. People call it like a ghost town because obviously they closed many of the shops. But the person we met with named Abu Muhammad, he's remained open even though the Israelis have literally tried everything they can to get him to leave his home and to leave his shop in the street. They've done things from bribery, arrest, and even physically attacking his shop. So recently, there's this Israeli politician named Baruch Marzel who organized a gang of 20 settlers to smash all of the items in his shop, and they recorded it for his campaign video. So it's like, vote for Baruch, smashing the items and like beating him up, and then it's like, yay, vote for me. And it's like really messed up that this is like the culture under apartheid. And like in the video, you would see how like the Israeli soldiers really follow and try to intimidate people who are trying to visit, even people like us who aren't residents, because they're so afraid of people hearing the stories of people like Abu Muhammad. And I just want to mention one last thing about Al-Khalil is that the people we met with in the organization Human Rights Defenders, they, prior to our meeting with them, they were attacked in their own home. The man we met with, his wife was beaten, and she was actually beaten so badly that in the middle of our meeting, he got up and had to talk to someone about how his wife needed additional treatment in the hospital because her condition was so severe. He left our meeting and went to go visit his wife in the hospital. So this just goes to show, you know, the people we met with show that despite the repression that they face in Al-Khalil, their attachment to each other and to their land is stronger than any Israeli weapon, than any Israeli bulldozer, and certainly any Israeli tank that attempts to destroy them. You know, directly resisting land theft and settler expansion is one of the most dangerous forms of resistance, but is in defense of the Palestinians' most basic interest, the right to life in their land. So Palestinians in Al-Khalil prove to us that there's no room for compromise on this basic right. Palestinians have the right to their own land.
here. Mm-hmm. Which part are we skipping?
I'm on the my inside for you. It's okay.
Are you sure?
Yeah, go for it.
No, you should do yours. Yours is more important.
We don't have time yet. Let's go.
Okay. So we're going to try to summarize this a little bit. The last area that we want to talk about with resisting land theft is, of course, 1948 Palestine. Particularly the Bedouin villages of 1948 that all reside in what's called Al-Naqab or the Negev. This area is actually 2/3 of what is considered today the state of Israel is where the Bedouins lived. And once Israel was established, the Bedouins were forced to live in only 10% of the land that they lived on. And as part of like the cultural erasure of the Bedouins, the Israelis attempted to urbanize them by building only 7 cities for them to live on in this 10% of land. And land theft of the Bedouins can be traced to a specific law that the Israelis passed called the Planning and Construction Law, which, similar to like the whole green areas thing, they designate areas for agricultural purposes or farming purposes. So the most number of Jewish-only farms called kibbutz are in this area of Al-Naqab where the Bedouins used to live. And the irony really of this agricultural law is that it outlaws the existence of Bedouins in their own land. And for this reason, the Israeli settlers actually call Bedouins settlers. So if you go on like an Israeli tour, they point to the Bedouins and are like, look at the settlers, even though it's their land, right? So because the Bedouins are outlawed, if they have a village that remains in the area that they lived, they're unrecognized by the state of Israel, right? So this means, of course, they don't receive any state services despite paying taxes to the state of Israel, and they can be demolished at any moment. So the organization that we met with in Al-Naqab, the Bedouin organization, is called the Negev Coexistence Forum for Civil Equality. And basically, they explained their struggle to be officially recognized by the state of Israel in order to prevent forced displacement, demolition, as well as receive necessary services like water, electricity, and waste management. The Negev Forum also keeps a record of home demolitions, and they list several Bedouin villages that have been demolished over 130 times. So what this means is that it's demolished and rebuilt. It's demolished and rebuilt 130 times. There were several villages that were listed in the archive as being demolished over that number. So we believe this really exemplifies the resistance and the resilience of the Bedouins, who even after having their homes demolished, they commit to remaining on their land. Perfect.
All right, so we'll just wrap it up here. And we wanted to end it by talking about the refugee camps and the question of the refugees, for lack of a better way of putting it. I just want to say as a side note, we do have report backs from every single day and every organization we visited. This is not comprehensive. Our presentation clearly isn't. But those reports that are on the table, they're free. Grab one if you want to read through them. They're also available on our website. So you'll be able to read a lot more than we're able to cover in just an hour. So the last thing that we want to talk about is refugees and refugee camps. So we visited a number of camps. We visited Dehesha, Balata, Askar Jadid or Nu' Askar, Jenin, and Aida refugee camp in the West Bank. We also visited Al-Baqa and Al-Wahdat camp in Jordan. Al-Baqa is home to 120,000 Palestinians in a refugee camp. And there are tens and hundreds of thousands in refugee camps around the world, and the Palestinians remain the largest refugee population in the world. And this is the kind of the hardest part to talk about, because what do you talk about a refugee camp? You could talk about how amazing the people are for getting up every single day, committing to educating their children, committing to organizing as much as they can in the camp, and never forgetting about where they come from. But you could talk about the destitution of all of these camps without even basic water or sewage systems. You could talk about the Balata refugee camp, in which the homes are built so close together that you can't walk between them. One of the people who was with us actually got stuck in an alley between two homes and had to like kind of walk himself back because they're so close together. And the when people get married in the refugee camp in Balata, they actually, the bride, in traditional Arab weddings, you kind of like walk the bride. It's called a zephah, right? You walk the bride. Brides are actually taken over the rooftops of the buildings instead of through the streets because there's no room, because the camp is so overcrowded. But what can we say about the camps and about refugees except one thing? From the youngest child who would run after us practicing their English to the oldest person we met who was over 90 years old and a survivor of the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, every single person said the same exact thing when asked. They all said that we want to go back home. And home is not a refugee camp. Home is the original homes and lands that they are from. It is enshrined in international law that refugee populations, no matter who they are allowed to return to their original homes and lands. There is no Palestinian exception to international law, regardless of how the international community may act. Palestinian refugees and their descendants have a right to return to their original homes and lands. Full stop. That's it. The other thing that we wanted to talk about, we talk about this because at USPCN we organize around what is called Thawabit, the constants of the Palestinian struggle. There are three constants that are never changing. The right of return for Palestinian refugees and their descendants, their original homes and lands. The right for national liberation and self-determination for the Palestinian people. And an end to the Israeli colonization and occupation of all Palestinian and Arab land. These are the three things that we organize around. These are our three demands, and these are the three things that every single Palestinian that you will meet in Palestine will tell you. There can be no negotiations about these three things. These are enshrined in international law. They are unchanging now and forever. They are not for the Palestinian Authority to give away. They are not for the Israeli state to give away. And they are certainly not for the American administration to give away in a quote-unquote deal of the century. And so we wanted to end it there on that note. This is the conclusion of our trip, the right of return for all Palestinian refugees to their original homes and lands, national liberation and self-determination for the Palestinian people, and an end to Israeli colonization and occupation of all Palestinian and Arab land. We'll stick around a little bit. Thank you all so much for coming to our talk, and thank you again to Moraine and Suzanne especially. Please remember you can grab a booklet that has a more comprehensive report on every single day of our tour and a couple of things that we weren't able to cover because of time.